It may be over soon, victory declared. It may not. The longer the US-Israeli war with Iran continues, the more the collateral damage to the world economy. Mostly because of the impact on energy prices. But why are we all so vulnerable still to events in one small part of the world and one tiny channel in that small part, the infamous Strait of Hormuz? What does it tell us about the problems of global energy and oil dependency, and what could be done to alleviate them? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, that dire strait. I'm joined by Ben Chu, policy and analysis correspondent for BBC Verify. Ben Chu, what's the big problem in the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, the Strait of Hormuz is this narrow waterway that separates the Persian Gulf from the Arabian Gulf and ultimately the Indian Ocean and the wider world. It's a very, very narrow waterway. It's only about 24 miles wide at its narrowest point. And actually, the shipping lanes are only about 2 miles wide. So it's extremely constricted. And a huge amount of the world's energy comes through there. Also, a huge amount of the world's fertilizers, a large share of the world's metals as well. The problem is that as a result of the US and Israel war with Iran, those vital resources can't get out of that area, creating big problems for the world economy.
Which countries specifically are we talking about who are locked up, if you like, behind the strait?
Yeah, so to the north of the strait is Iran, and then directly south is the United Arab Emirates and Oman, and also Saudi Arabia. And further up in the Persian Gulf, you've got Iraq and Kuwait, which use the strait to get their oil out as well. So those are the main countries affected.
Why isn't all that stuff carried by pipelines instead of going on ships through this narrow strait?
It's true that Saudi Arabia and Oman have made efforts in recent years to stop being so reliant on the strait in terms of getting their own oil out. So they've built pipelines which go across the landmass to the Red Sea and sort of bypass the strait in the case of Oman. But the issue is they're still very, very reliant on the seaborne strait for oil exports. There have been efforts to try and bypass it, but they've not been sufficient to stop this kind of crunch that we're seeing now.
To me, it seems like a pipeline should be able to carry more stuff than a ship can and so on. But obviously, I've got that wrong, haven't I?
Well, the pipelines they've built are pretty substantial in the case of Saudi Arabia, but such a large volume is exported from the Gulf, and the countries like Iraq and Kuwait and the Emirates just don't have the capacity or haven't had the capacity to build sufficiently large pipelines to replace the strait. And of course, the strait hasn't been blocked until now, so they've been able to rely on it pretty well for many, many decades.
You mentioned fertilizer. What else is being transported out of the area?
Yeah, well, it's really important to recognize that it isn't just fertilizer, it isn't just oil and liquefied natural gas. It's metals like aluminium, it's metals like sulfur, which is really important in mining and machine making. It's things like helium, which is really, really important.
Helium?
Helium is important. It's a byproduct of the oil and gas production process, but it's vitally important in semiconductor production.
Now, Ben, the threat to the strait is not the only problem with what's happened to the energy infrastructure during this war, is it? I mean, other things have been hit.
Yeah, obviously, it's a double impact. It's the inability to get it out on tankers, but also strikes on key oil and gas production facilities in the area. I think the two biggest ones are probably very early in the conflict. On the 2nd of March, there was a drone strike on a liquefied natural gas export terminal in Qatar called Ras Laffan that has been taken offline. And that's really important because that's about 18% of global shipments.
Is it still offline?
It's still offline. 18% of global shipments of LNG, liquefied natural gas, come from that one terminal. That's what sent gas prices up very, very sharply early in the conflict, global wholesale gas prices. And then on the same day, there was an attack on the Saudi oil refinery called Ras Tanura, and that was brought offline as well. Again, we think it's because of an Iranian drone strike. And just this week, we've had attacks on refineries in Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates as well. So those are the sort of land-based oil and gas infrastructure that have been hit. But we've had strikes on tankers as well, around the Straits of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf. And there were three more strikes on commercial shipping on Wednesday night as well.
Some of these places have been put out of commission, but presumably there is a significant amount still of gas production and oil production, which can't actually get out. Is it being stored, or what happens to it?
Yeah, well, this is a really important part of the picture. It's not just the inability of the tankers and the liquefied natural gas ships to get out. It's the inability of the big producers to continue producing if they have nowhere to store it. There's been some analysis done about how much storage there is by JP Morgan, a US investment bank, and they estimated that there's about enough storage on land in these countries like Kuwait, Iraq and United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, and also on ships, on tankers, to maybe store it for 25 days. But actually, Kuwait and Iraq have already started to curtail down production, and it's estimated they've taken about 6 to 7 million barrels a day of oil production out of commission already. So the nations of the International Energy Agency have agreed a historic release of oil stockpiles, around 400 million barrels, which is a lot of oil. But the reality is, considering how much is being disrupted coming out of the Strait of Hormuz, it would only cover that 400 million around 20 to 25 days.
It's slightly peculiar then, isn't it, that the oil price went up, you can remind us just how high, and then seemed to kind of come down a bit. How do we explain that?
Well, the truth is that oil has been on a huge roller coaster ride in terms of the price since this conflict started. So let's go back to the 1st of March, just after the initial strikes. Oil jumped considerably from around $70 to $82. But a lot of analysts said that that was relatively muted given the scale of the disruption. Then on Sunday, the 8th of March, as traders and analysts said that this is probably not going to be a short war, it suddenly spiked up to $120 for a barrel of crude oil. Now, it came back down really, really sharply the next day after Donald Trump suggested that he wanted to bring the conflict to an end, came down to about $90. But after those three new attacks on ships on Wednesday night, it went back briefly above $100 again. And that was despite that announcement by the IEA of that historic release of oil reserves.
Ben Chu. And before we move on, a reminder about the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can find the entire back catalogue, such as the recent one, which asks about the chances of regime change in Iran, and the one which looks at the US capture of the former Venezuelan president in January. Now back to the geopolitics of oil and gas. I'm joined in the studio by economist and author Duncan Weldon, Bill Farren-Price, who's senior research fellow and head of gas research at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, he's in Oxford, and Rosemary Kalanick, who's director of the Middle East programme at the US think tank Defence Priorities. Bill Farren-Price, why can't the US just reopen the Strait of Hormuz? Can't it just force this to happen?
Yeah, I mean, in all the scenarios that we've built over the last decades, worrying about this kind of Armageddon scenario, we assumed that the US military would just open the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, there are two pathways in which this could happen, one military and one political with the end of the conflict. And it doesn't seem at the moment that is going to happen. So we have no visibility on the political pathway to get out of this, despite mixed messages coming from the US. And no real way to see a military solution that has credibility, at least for the captains and crews of the ships that have to sail through the Strait.
I mean, remind us just how much has to pass through the Strait and how much you'd have to safeguard. And if you could also just take us through the problem of insurance. In other words, it's not just that things will actually get attacked, but it's that insurers might think they'll get attacked.
That's right. Insurance is becoming unaffordable for shippers, I think. President Trump offered some sort of workaround for that. There's a huge number of not just energy shipments, and that involves crude oil, refined products, and LNG from Qatar and the UAE as well. 20% of global supply comes from the Gulf, but there's also a lot of standard container vessels and other bulk shipments that need to pass through there, and they're all vulnerable. So clearly, this is a completely unsustainable situation for global energy markets, but not just that, for the global economy at large.
Rosemary, what would the US have to do militarily in order to ensure passage for everybody through the Strait of Hormuz up to the kind of level that was happening before?
Yeah, so it's a very difficult problem militarily, particularly because we have a revolution in the past 10 years or so with cheap drones being available to everyone, and Iran can mass produce drones. And so the difficulty is that Iran can use what's essentially like guerrilla tactics. They can use drones, they can use missiles, they can use mines, but they don't have to. They can use speedboats laden with explosives or speedboats that attach mines to the side of hulls to attack shipping. And it's very difficult for the United States to solve that problem, especially because it's throughout the entire Persian Gulf. So there was a tanker about 30 miles off the coast of Kuwait that was attacked by a speedboat earlier in this conflict. And in terms of operating in the Strait of Hormuz, it's so narrow that if U.S. military assets are in the strait, whether they're helicopters or ships, they're vulnerable to attack from the shore. And of course, Iran has been preparing for this mission literally for decades. So it's risky. It's risky for the United States militarily. That said, at this point, more of an insurance problem than a military problem, whether shippers will take on the added risk of going through the strait under fire, which they have done in previous conflicts, but it's not clear so far that that's going to happen.
Bill, if a large oil tanker gets hit trying to go through the strait, how big an environmental problem would that be in the area?
Yeah, I mean, it could be pretty catastrophic. If you saw a loss of cargo into the sea, that would impact all the coastal communities that rely upon fishing and tourism. You could imagine a pretty disastrous outcome. But there's also the potential for those vessels to catch on fire and to have the problems that you would associate with that, or even sink in the major channels that could effectively block channels as well.
Rosemary, can you explain to me why the Strait of Hormuz, which has been seen as being a pinch point of this kind for, well, half a century, hasn't it? Why we're all still so dependent upon this narrow waterway when it's been a vulnerability for so long?
Yeah, so, there's two answers to that. One is simply the geography. It's very cheap and easy to move oil across water, and so you send it through the strait. It makes sense. But the other reason is that the United States offered a military guarantee to protect oil shipping coming out of the Persian Gulf, and they did that in 1980. It's called the Carter Doctrine, when Carter said in the State of the Union address that year that the U.S. would protect free shipping coming from the Persian Gulf. And so arguably, by essentially saying that Hormuz was too big to fail, it wasn't an implicit security guarantee, it was explicit security guarantee. The U.S. potentially undermined the incentives for market actors to find alternate routes, because why build a costly pipeline to the Red Sea or to the Mediterranean when the United States Navy has said they will guarantee shipping through the strait?
Bill, do you bear that out, which is essentially without a kind of incentive to diversify routes, countries have just decided that they'll live with it?
Well, it's always worked up till now. And there are a couple of bypass pipelines that kind of can mitigate some of the missing volumes, one in Saudi and one in the UAE. But yes, I think the issue is that the US has become more energy independent, and it's less motivated to sort of police these kind of pinch points that used to be so critical for its own energy supply. And I think that that's one of the reasons that we're seeing this crisis now. It's the US is more, I would argue, probably more lukewarm about these kind of commitments that they made in the 80s under Carter.
So, Duncan, what's not quite so clear is why the Middle East is still such an important player in the oil and gas markets.
I mean, a few reasons. To start with, they have a lot of oil and gas, but it's not just that they have a lot of oil and gas. They have oil and gas, which is, particularly in terms of oil, very easy to access compared to some other types of oil in the world. So if you look at how much it costs to get a barrel of oil out of the ground in Saudi Arabia, you get estimates of only $10, $15 a barrel. You know, this stuff's selling at $70, $80, $90 a barrel. If you compare that to, say, Venezuela, it can cost them $60, $65 to get a barrel of oil. So they've got lots of oil and gas and easy to access oil and gas. And also the clue is sort of in the name Middle East. The Middle East is very well positioned for supplying oil and gas across Eurasia into both Europe and eastwards to Asia.
How much of the world's oil is actually supplied by these countries?
So it depends on if we're looking at just crude or if we're including refined products as well. But depending on your exact definition, something like 15 to 20 million barrels a day pass through the Strait of Hormuz. Total global oil usage is just over 100 million barrels per day, so you know, around a fifth.
Could we do without it if it's 15 to 20%, or does it play a sort of outsized role apart from the cost thing that you talked about?
I mean, the Middle East plays a really important role as, you know, what an economist would call the supplier of the marginal barrel of oil when it's needed. But what I mean by that is, because they have access to so much oil in particular that they can get out of the ground at a fairly low cost, it's sort of the safety valve in the global economy. If oil demand is soaring, it's usually easier for Middle Eastern producers to ramp up production to meet it. On the other hand, if oil production is falling, you know, the Middle East can balance that by cutting back production as well. So it plays this really important outsized role in the global oil market.
Can we move on, Duncan, to the question of the kind of economic damage that higher fossil fuel prices, which will be the result of this, already is the result, can do? How does that work through?
Okay, so the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, towards the end of 2023, said they estimate in their central case that a sustained, and sustained is an important word there, a sustained 10% increase in the price of oil adds about 0.4% to inflation across the globe and reduces global output by about 0.15%. Now, that's a global impact. And obviously, you know, the impact on different countries varies. In general, what a big reduction in the supply of oil or any other fossil fuel does is it lowers output, it increases inflation, and it redistributes money away from users of fossil fuels towards the producers of fossil fuels.
And in those circumstances, what do people like banks do?
People like banks aren't very, very happy in a situation like this. When you've got inflation being higher than otherwise would have been, what you expect is interest rates to be higher than they otherwise would be. That has all sorts of implications for bond markets, for government borrowing costs. It tends to make people much more risk adverse. So you see, you know, the prices of stocks and shares falling as well. You know, generally what we see is when we get a geopolitical problem, when we get a spike in energy costs, you see the prices of financial assets falling.
Right. Rosemary, can we look at the impact on the global economy of fossil fuels? I'm asking you this because we've talked for the last, 35, 40 years about replacing fossil fuels with renewable energy for climate change reasons and also for energy security reasons. What has actually happened?
Yeah, so some progress has been made, but I'd say that there's two different problems that need to be solved. One problem is transportation, which really stands alone. And transportation relies extremely heavily on oil. You know, in the United States, something like 88% of transportation is powered by oil. And the number is similarly high in many other countries, although it's getting lower because of EVs, electric vehicles. And now that we have a breakthrough in EVs, there's possibilities in the future that oil demand in countries that adopt them can go down significantly. The other fossil fuels, natural gas, coal, et cetera, and pertinent to this discussion, of course, is natural gas. That's used much more for generating electricity and generating heat. And natural gas is not a global market. So, you know, the United States has not been particularly affected by increases in natural gas prices, whereas Europe has been. But the U.S. is affected by increases in oil prices because it pays the global market price no matter where it gets its oil. And we have made some progress in terms of substituting coal and natural gas. We're adding renewables to the grid, et cetera. That solves the electricity generation problem, but it doesn't solve the transportation problem unless you start plugging EVs into the electricity grid.
Duncan, going away from the United States for a moment and looking at some of the other countries, I mean, not too long ago, I remember seeing that countries like Pakistan and other countries which don't have the money to pay higher and higher gas prices are desperately trying to diversify out of them and buying renewable energy sources from other places.
Oh, they absolutely are. And, you know, cheap Chinese solar panels are appearing all over, say, Pakistan. But, you know, that progress has only gone so far. Over the last week, we've seen, you know, what's happened with energy prices really start to bite across a lot of Asia. So we have, you know, restaurants saying they're going to have to close in Bangalore because they can't source heating oil. And it's worth saying changes in global oil prices feed through very quickly to Americans at the pump because there are so few taxes on what they call gas, that, you know, the wholesale price of oil is a big part of it. So as oil prices rise, the price they are paying at the pump rises much faster than it does in Europe, where tax is a bigger percentage of the what you're paying at the forecourt. But yeah, so outside of the United States, though, a big hit in Asia and a big hit in Europe.
Bill, how is the UK currently being affected?
It's affected both for oil and gas. We've seen those prices go up, and we've also seen power prices go up because gas is the marginal element of the electricity price, because gas is used to generate power. So we've seen that go up as well. Now, what that means longer term, if this situation continues, is that you'll start to see the energy input costs for manufacturing, for industry, and for agriculture go up as well, which means ultimately less competitive export goods and more expensive goods in the shops for Brits.
Duncan Weldon.
Well, obviously, what's fresh in everyone's mind is what happened in 2022 after Russia invaded Ukraine, when energy prices spiked. We had the energy price guarantee. The government basically stepped in, capped bills for households and firms, and absorbed those costs itself. I think the government will be very reluctant to do something on that scale again, because it was very, very expensive.
Rosemary, you're in Indiana at the moment. Is it a shock to ordinary Americans to realise that they are still vulnerable to oil price shocks?
Yes, I think it is. And that's sort of just starting to register among the population, because we've only just seen prices increase in the past week or so in a noticeable way. And I do think that there's a misperception in the United States that because we produce so much oil, that we could be self-sufficient in oil, that we're insulated from these sorts of shocks, but we're not. And the fact of the matter is that the United States is actually more impacted than China or Russia or EU countries, because the United States' oil intensity is extremely high. So for every dollar of GDP produced in the United States, the U.S. consumes more oil than it takes for China or Britain to produce GDP in their countries.
One country that may not be hurt, of course, is Russia, which produces a lot of oil and which up until fairly recently, up until the Ukrainian war, was supplying quite a lot of it. Bill, can you take us through what you think is likely to happen there, and remind us maybe what was happening before Russia invaded Ukraine and what might be coming?
There was a G7 price cap on Russian oil that was a form of sanctions aimed at keeping Russian oil flowing, but reducing the revenues available to the Russian treasury to fund the war in Ukraine. Now, what seems to be happening is that there are discussions underway between the US and Russia to ease some of the sanctions on Russian oil, to basically try to ease some of this this supply shock that's been created by the problem in the Gulf. So in some ways, Russia is going to benefit from this situation as a supplier of oil with pent-up availability of supply. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Also, the other thing to say is that Europe has announced a imminent ban on all Russian energy imports. And it'll be interesting to see whether the Europeans are forced to at least delay some of those measures while this crisis goes on.
Bill, how are the Chinese dealing with this?
The Chinese, you would expect to be panicking. I mean, they do rely upon Middle Eastern imported energy of one kind or another. And they have so far appeared to have taken the view that they will remain calm and not interfere and not seek to make the situation worse, perhaps. But they have a long-standing partnership with Iran. They have been active there in terms of energy, in terms of industry and investment. And of course, as I say, they have a lot to lose in terms of a gap in their imports. Of course, they have diversified imports with energy, with gas coming from Russia and Central Asia, and oil coming from other suppliers as well as the Middle East. But they are one of the big consumers. So it'll be interesting to see the moment at which China steps up and becomes a little bit more proactive in trying to perhaps mediate in this crisis and try to find a way out.
Okay, it's crystal ball time, although some of these crystal balls have a relatively short shelf life. Rosemary, what are the implications if the war ends fairly soon? If it does, can everyone just return to business as usual, or will there be longer-term damage to energy supply?
A little bit of both, I think. So some of the production that's been shut in the Gulf, both natural gas and oil, can't immediately be turned on or turned back on. It can take weeks or even months to ramp up potentially. So there could be a lingering effect. But I still think, you know, either way, just having this sort of shock will be a wake-up call politically and economically, just like after the 1973 oil crisis, where the fact that we had these major price increases, oil quadrupled within the span of a few weeks during that crisis, that led to massive improvements in energy efficiency. It led to stopping burning oil for electricity by and large in the United States, right? The market responded in all kinds of ways, and the global economy as a whole is 50% less dependent on oil than it was back then. So it could have far-reaching implications.
Not all of them totally negative.
Correct. It could be better for the environment at the end of the day if countries turn to green energy, renewables, etc.
That's at the end of the day, Bill. Before the end of the day, how's it going to look?
I don't see any pathway to resolving this critical supply shock that we're facing. So I think it's going to go on. I totally agree with Rosemary about the time it will take to get things started, even if we were to have a breakthrough. I suspect that political forces will need to step up a lot more than they're doing so far if we're going to see any sort of resolution on this.
Do you mean step up in order to secure some form of peace agreement?
That's right, yeah. Put pressure on the warring parties to call it a day and try and see where the dust settles.
What do you think about the medium-term impact of something like this? And let's assume that the war continues for a little bit and then peters out. What will we still be looking at?
There is a huge range of possible outcomes. To give you a sense of that, on Monday at the start of this week, over the course of 24 hours, the price of a barrel of oil varied from a low of about $85 a barrel to a high of almost $120 a barrel. That's a year's worth of oil price moves we had over the course of 24 hours as people worked out different scenarios and what was more likely. The crucial variable here now is time, and how long the strait is closed for. If the strait opens in the next week, then it's going to take another 5 or 6 weeks to get production back up and running. There's going to be some, you know, disruption to the global economy, but it's all manageable. If the strait is closed for another 4 weeks or 6 weeks or 8 weeks, those problems become really, really quite magnified. And we're talking about high energy prices all throughout this year. If the strait is still closed in 3 or 4 months' time, then all bets are off and we're in a really, truly grim economic situation in the short term.
That's all we've got time for. My thanks to Duncan Weldon, Bill Farren-Price, Rosemary Kalanick and Ben Chu. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Kirsty Knight and Nathan Gower. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli, the sound engineer was Neil Churchill, and the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
What would you do if your deepest secrets were held to ransom? In 2020, every patient who had used a Finnish psychotherapy service called Vastamo had their therapy notes stolen and held to ransom by a faceless, remorseless hacker.
It could be some extortionist gang from Eastern Europe, or it could be somebody living next door to me.
I'm Jenny Kleeman. Join me as I discover just how vulnerable our deepest secrets can be.
I think I'm going to have a heart attack.
From BBC Radio 4 and Intrigue, this is Ransom Man. Listen first on BBC Sounds.